fighters to unite. We are with you from Gaza, the 1948 occupied lands, the West Bank, and even from outside Palestinian territories in Lebanon and Syria. We are all awaiting the leader, Mohammed al-Deif's commands to start battle and free Palestine.
On a separate incident, the Israeli forces murdered a Palestinian woman in Huwara town in Nablus. The assassination raised the death toll of the Palestinians to at least 102, including 20 children so far in 2023. During the vigil, people chanted slogans in defiance of the Israeli occupation and called for retaliation.
The Palestinian resistance is much more experienced against the Israeli occupation. They started with nonviolent approaches and then raised the bar for the Zionist enemy due to its brutality against the Palestinians. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank learned lessons from what happened in Gaza and are now following their footsteps. The Israelis know that the resistance is now invincible. They are certain that the resistance is able to bring them down, especially when the Netanyahu cabinet faces serious challenges in the occupied lands.
Tensions have been escalating in the West Bank in the past months. The Israeli army has intensified its operations into the Palestinian cities and towns, during which they arrested and killed tens of Palestinians. The Israeli regime commits human rights violations and war crimes on a daily basis against the Palestinian people across all Palestinian territories. And with every crime, it knows that it becomes harder to restrain the Palestinian resistance actions. Ulal Asi, Gaza.
Millions of struggling homeowners with tracker mortgages across the 27-nation eurozone will soon start paying back even more following a decision by the European Central Bank to increase interest rates by a quarter of 1%.
We have covered a lot of ground in the last 9 months, right? Moving from minus 50 basis points to plus 300 basis points. We are continuing this hiking process.
Rents are going up as landlords with mortgages pass on the costs. The aim is to bring down inflation, but disgruntled unions insist the strategy won't work. It's all linked to energy sanctions against Russia. EU citizens are being financially pummeled. However, the bloc's leaders have just agreed on a huge additional package to arm Ukraine.
So we are talking about $1 billion capacity to upscale our industrial base.
Ordinary people don't see an end in sight to the crippling cost of living crisis.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
Analysts suggest peace in Ukraine is the answer, but EU authorities say Kiev will be supplied with deadly weapons for as long as it takes.
It is for Ukraine, that is the country that has been attacked, to decide in which conditions it is ready to find peace with Russia.
Employment ministers have been assessing pressures on EU businesses due to high inflation and interest rates. Firms are also struggling to find skilled workers.
26% of companies all over Europe consider that labour shortage are a major difficulty for them.
Because EU leaders have cut off cheap gas and oil flows from Russia, winter 2023 will tell us all we need to know about the bloc's resilience, or lack thereof. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Italy-France government relationship appears to be again in freefall after French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said on Thursday that the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni is incapable of solving Italy's migrant crisis on which she was elected. The derogatory remarks, also reiterated by French Transport Minister Clément Beaune on Friday, have caused uproar in the Italian government. Prime Minister Meloni is said to be on the verge of cancelling a planned trip to Paris to meet French President Emmanuel Macron, while Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has demanded Paris an apology for what he called gratuitous and vulgar insults towards a friendly and allied country.
This rift of immigration can be framed in a European context with Italy that has repeatedly demanded to improve the burden distribution across the EU. This umpteenth diplomatic spat between Rome and Paris takes place on the backdrop of a new humanitarian emergency in Sudan, which can greatly exacerbate the migrant crisis.
Rome and Paris have often been at loggerheads in recent years. The latest rift dates back to November last year, when a French NGO-run search and rescue vessel carrying more than 230 asylum seekers was refused a port of safety by Italy's government for around 3 weeks. On that occasion, in response to the situation, the French government suspended plans to take in 3,500 refugees who had landed in Italy, contravening the European Union's migrant relocation mechanism.
We firmly believe that Brussels must develop a coherent approach to distributing the migrants across the EU. About 94,000 migrants landed in Italy in 2022. You know how many migrants were relocated to France? 38. And to Germany? 57.
Later on Friday, Paris sought to play down the fresh row with Rome, saying that Italy is an essential partner to France and their relationship is founded on mutual respect. Meanwhile, migrant arrivals in Italy have more than tripled from last year. The country's recent centres are overcrowded and some have passed the breaking point. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi on Thursday wrapped up his two-day visit to Syria, where he met with his counterpart Bashar al-Assad. The visit was the first by an Iranian president to Syria since the Arab country was gripped by war in 2011. Raisi has called his Syria visit a turning point in bilateral ties.
This trip will be a turning point in Iran-Syria relations and will have an effect on the region and the trade and economic relations of the two countries.
The Iranian and Syrian governments have also issued a joint statement that highlights several points. The two sides have expressed strong determination to cement bilateral relations in different areas, particularly trade and economy. On Wednesday, the first day of his trip, the Iranian president signed a long-term comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement with his Syrian counterpart at the presidential palace in Damascus. Raisi said the long-term agreement will open a new chapter in cordial relations. 14 more documents were signed as well, all aiming to enhance bilateral cooperation. Iran, meanwhile, renewed its readiness to help Syria in its reconstruction efforts following the years-long conflict triggered by foreign-backed militancy. The pledge was made by President Raisi as he made a speech at the Holy Shrine of Hazrat Zainab, the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad. Raisi also lashed out at the U.S. and Israel for backing terror groups in Syria.
For 12 years, the oppressed people hatched conspiracies and committed sedition, gave easy money to Daesh and Takfiri terrorist groups, used media empires to conduct psychological warfare, inflicted damage, destroyed homes, killed children, and made women homeless. For 12 years, the U.S., Israel, and the Takfiri Daesh terrorist groups they backed committed crimes in Syria. But Syria is standing strong today.
Combating terrorism is another issue Iran and Syria put focus on in their joint statement. They've pledged to continue to work together to fight terrorism and extremism until all terror groups are completely wiped out. The statement also denounces the U.S. military presence in Syria as well as its looting of the country's natural resources. It demands the international community to bring an end to the U.S. measures. The Iranian-Syrian statement also denounces Western sanctions imposed on both nations. Meanwhile, it slammed the Israeli regime for its repeated acts of aggression against Syria, saying that Damascus has the right to respond to Tel Aviv's aggression. The statement said that the Israeli aggression is a destabilizing factor in West Asia. Iran has said President Raisi's visit to Syria is in line with efforts to reinforce the axis of resistance in West Asia, including in the occupied territories, Lebanon and Syria itself. This should be seen against the backdrop of Israel's weakening position in the region, as the regime is gripped by turmoil inside and facing mountain resistance outside. Iran and Syria are both under Western economic sanctions. The restrictive measures, however, seem to be a blessing in disguise for both nations as they're resolute in overcoming economic hurdles by forming stronger bonds and relying on their own potentialities.
On Thursday, about 6,000 employees from the Italian phone carrier Wind Tre walked out of work in protest against the management's decision to spin off the firm's network assets into a separate company. Wind Tre is the third largest Italian mobile operator with about 20 million customers and the second largest fixed line operator with almost 3 million subscribers. The industrial action had been called by Italy's three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and UIL, against the unbundling deal, which unions and workers say is the prelude to mass layoffs.
We have to stand united against this spin-off. Breaking up companies always leads to detrimental consequences for workers. The best-case scenario is that we get further stripped of working rights. The worst is thousands of layoffs.
The spin-off of telecoms operator Wind Tre will pave the way for the sale of a majority stake in the grid company to Swedish private equity firm EQT. Unionists say Wind Tre will shift some 2,000 workers out of a total 6,500 workers in Italy into the network venture.
Sta cambiando il modello industriale.
The industrial system as a whole is shifting towards a new paradigm in the communication sector, which features separating the management of the network grid from that of services. This way, Italy will further lose control on its strategic assets, and many smaller companies will kick in, exacerbating job insecurity in the country.
Job insecurity is rampant in Italy. According to statistical agency Eurostat's figures, Italy has the second lowest employment rate for young workers in Europe at about 30%. Also, Italy has no minimum wage but protects workers through collective agreements, which often remains a dead letter for people on precarious contracts. Meanwhile, Italy's government has scrapped an anti-poverty benefit that goes under the name of citizen income, replacing it with a more limited inclusion check for qualifying households starting from January 2024. Prime Minister Meloni argues that the citizen income, which helped about 4 million people last year, costs too much and discourages people, especially youths, from looking for jobs.
Personally, I have been forever looking for a dignifying job, but the only things I'm offered are badly paid long-hour jobs. The citizen income should have been amended, but not scrapped altogether.
Nearly half of workers aged between 30 and 34 in Italy have an income between 8,000 and 16,000 euro a year, an income bracket that ranges from absolute poverty to near subsistence. An increasing number of Italians are leaving the country in search of better opportunities abroad. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. In this edition, foreign ministers of the Arab League member states have agreed to reinstate Syria's membership after its suspension more than 10 years ago. The turn of events comes amid a flurry of regional normalization of ties with Damascus in recent weeks. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the significance of this development ahead of the Arab League summit, which is set to be held in Saudi Arabia on May 19th. What this means for the region and for the world. To do so, we're joined by Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, who is joining us live from Beirut. We also have with us Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, who is joining us from Manchester.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Maruf from Beirut. Mr. Maruf, Syria's Arab League membership was revoked in 2011. What was the reason behind this in the first place?
Clearly, the reason behind it was the pressure of the United States on its local vessels to push out Syria, who was defending itself against an invasion by Wahhabi death squads, funded by the local vessels of the United States and backed by the CIA. Today, what we see is a return of the Arab League to Syria. It is not a return of Syria to the Arab League. It's a return of the Arab League to Syria and a return of all those countries that at one moment over those 11 years harmed Syria, coming back for ending those hostilities and almost begging for goodwill. And so now we see the importance of geography in the sense that Ibn Khaldun will tell us the fate that is written for Damascus because of its geographic location. The region cannot have a balance without Damascus being at the center of it. And of course, we see the Arab League coming back to Damascus. We see Turkey attempting to end its hostilities with Syria and a blossoming of the axis of resistance led with Iran, the president arriving in the last 2 days to Damascus also. So that's the importance of geography and the fate of the country of Syria.
Exactly. Those are very important issues you just mentioned. And 2023 seems to be a year of turning a new page, if you will, for regional developments as far as Syria is concerned. Let's bring in Mr. Ford. Mr. Ford, can you shed more light on the geostrategic location of Syria? And why didn't these countries consider this in the first place when they decided that Syria should not be part of the Arab League? Didn't they know how important Syria was? What did they have in mind back then?
Well, I think they had been deceived by the United States, which was telling them that, according to U.S. intelligence, the Assad government was bound to fall. It was just a matter of time. And the Arab states, or many of them, thought that they would join the U.S. push to overthrow the government of Syria. Some of them, let's not forget, also were supporting very actively some of the Gulf countries, particularly, were supporting the armed opposition groups. So they wanted to isolate Syria anyway. But a big factor was the U.S. pressure on Arab states.
So, Mr. Ford, do you believe that Bashar Assad's, let's say, the way he has solidified his position in Syria is the reason why these Arab countries are turning back towards Syria?
That's a big part of the reason, but there are other factors in play. It's very interesting now we're seeing the Arab world, led particularly by Saudi Arabia, in a new partnership with Cairo, more defiant towards America, no longer prepared to be dictated to by the United States. Believe me, this development is a bitter blow for the United States. They tried to pressure countries like Jordan, weaker countries, not to join in the consensus, but this failed. This year, partly as a result of the geopolitical situation with Ukraine, partly because of general U.S. Weakness and failure from Afghanistan through Ukraine and China policy, the Arab countries are more ready to be independent, and that means readmitting Syria to the Arab League and, for most of them, normalizing relations.
So, Mr. Maruf, in your opinion, well, Saudi Arabia, we do know that it had long resisted normalization of ties with Damascus. Why this change of heart at this point in time?
As our guest mentioned just a minute ago, the international scene changing, the end of American hegemony and the rise of multipolarity. And we have to actually credit Syria for this rise of the new world of multipolar reality. Without the wall of Damascus, without the government of Syria, the military of Syria, the structures of Syria withstanding this 11 years of war and this international coalition that the United States led invading the country, Russia wouldn't be in a position today to actually defend itself, for instance, in Ukraine. Imagine if those Wahhabi death squads that the United States on Syria, if they survived, where they would be today and how they would be moved, as we see the Nazi militias being moved to the Ukraine. So Syria was actually the beginning of this multipolar world. It's the time when Russia took a position to finally intervene militarily in a location where the United States was invading with its proxies. So this is where we're at, and the world is changing. The Arab countries that may have been vessels of the United States for a good of 80 somewhat years since the end of World War I, World War II, are now finding themselves in a position where the United States cannot protect them, and their economic future is tied to Asia and Africa, not to Europe and North America. And that's why we see the shift. And of course, that increases the possibility that these former vessel states like the Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates or others that are normalizing with Syria right now will have a colored revolution plotted against it by the United States any minute now.
So, Mr. Ford, Mr. Maruf did point out that there is a new world order that is emerging. Do you believe that the United States is losing its grip on the Eastern Hemisphere with its plots have failed regarding Syria?
Absolutely. They're losing its grip. As the previous speaker just said, the United States push for global power more or less came to an end in about 2014, by which time it was beginning to fail in Syria. Syria had withstood the incoming tide from the U.S.-supported Arab Spring, and the tide had come to its highest point. And the same could be said about Ukraine. 2014 was an important year there also. And so everything we've seen in the last 9 years has been a weakening of the U.S. Stranglehold over the Middle East. There have been other important milestones as well, like the tanker war in the Gulf in about 2018. Which saw, among other things, an attack on a Saudi refinery. This proved that America could not defend its allies, and those allies, like Saudi Arabia, have now become realistic, are making peace with their old enemies, like Iran, and have realized that the best way to have security is not to have enemies.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Mr. Maruf, Saudi Arabian Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan visited Damascus last month for the first time in more than a decade. The two countries have decided to reopen their embassies, restore flights between the two countries. What is the significance of this escalation in bilateral ties, this rapprochement, if you will?
Well, basically, Saudi Arabia currently is the biggest financier and of most of the Arab states, let's say. That's why we see the Arab League right now jumping very fast into returning Syria into the organization because Saudi Arabia said so. And it means also the same thing for the Gulf states and the Gulf Cooperation Council. What Saudi Arabia says to these countries happens. So what does this mean? This means that right now, we will see an acceleration of this normalization between all the Arab states and Syria, the former states that stayed out of Syria since 2011. And partially, we will see some of those states paying a price for it, as we see Egypt already paying a price for that reality with the war in Sudan being instigated by the United States and Israel. To weaken it in this state. So we will see an increase of probable problems in those countries that are now normalizing with Syria by the United States pressure. And as you know, the reality is that Syria will be the winner of this no matter what. And it shows that resistance to American invasions is the right way to go, and it's worse to be a friend of the United States than to be its enemy.
Interesting. So, Mr. Ford, Jordan, Kuwait, and Qatar oppose Bashar al-Assad's presence in the Arab League. What are the reasons behind that, and how do you foresee the future for these three countries?
Well, each one of those is different. Jordan is weak, less able to withstand U.S. Pressure. Qatar has its particular problems with Saudi Arabia and never wants to follow a Saudi lead. There is a struggle between the petrol superpower, Saudi Arabia, and the gas superpower, Qatar, and at the moment the Saudis are winning. Kuwait has always been a maverick, but thankfully does not have huge significance today. What matters now is Saudi leadership. We will, in a matter of days, by May 19, the Arab summit, we will see Assad, no doubt, being welcomed at the Arab League summit in Riyadh. This will be a bitter blow for the United States, and it's also very important for what happens now inside Syria. The opposition, what's left of it, will be even more demoralized. The momentum now is all with the Syrian government. No doubt after the Turkish elections, the Turks will withdraw their troops from Syria, and all that remains then is for the armed opposition groups to negotiate terms of surrender. And this will leave the United States isolated as the remaining holdout.
So, Mr. Maruf, we discussed a new world order emerging, and of course, Mr. Ford also shed more light on the role that the United States used to play in the region and how that role has diminished. Now let's put Iran in the mix. Let's not forget that all of this is happening while Saudi Arabia and Iran have also reestablished their diplomatic ties and they're growing closer. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi visited Damascus just a few days ago, and that was, of course, a historic visit after nearly 12 years, a very important visit with lots of agreements being signed, bilateral relations expanding, particularly in trade and business. Tell us, what role does Iran play in this entire equation?
Well, of course, that visit was historic, and it solidified the alliance between Syria and Turkey that has been unshakable since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. And it was also a signal to the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, who may think that opening up the Arab League and some rebuilding and connections with Syria may sway Syria away from its brotherly relationship with Iran, that this will never happen. Of course, we must remember that Syria, in multiple times over the last 20 somewhat years since the invasion of Iraq, has been pressured and by the United States and offered much wealth and much trade if it gives up both the resistance in Lebanon and its relationship with Iran, and that never happened, even under the pressures of the war that lasted 10 years on Syria. So this is a very important also significance for Iran to show, this relationship, how for anybody else around the region, to show how this brotherly relationship is extendable to anybody, that we don't need foreign imperial forces in the region to safeguard everybody's security, and that only relationships that are brotherly between the nations of the region will guarantee that security. This is the significance of that visit.
That's an interesting point you raise there. So, Mr. Ford, it seems that the divide and rule policy that the West particularly has been trying to implement in the Eastern Hemisphere is now failing. Can you shed more light on that and, of course, Iran's role in this entire normalization of ties that we see?
Well, what's happened has been a victory for steadfastness. The Arabs call it sumud, steadfastness. And the steadfastness front, which includes Syria and Iran and Hezbollah, and some of the Palestinian groups. And they have shown patience over the last 12 years, patience which is now being rewarded at great speed. The momentum now is all with the resistance front, the steadfastness front, and the absolute pivot for this has been Iran. Without Iran, Syria would have fallen by 2014 or earlier. This, on the part of the United States, Syria was always, the war against Syria by America was always just a prelude to and part of the war against Iran. It was a way primarily to weaken Iran, ready for changing the government of Iran. Well, it's all come to nothing. It's now crumbling in a really embarrassing way. And this is why the United States is so angry tonight.
Thank you very much, Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, joining us live from Manchester, and Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. That's all the time that we have for this edition of The Spotlight, and I'm very grateful that you shared your thoughts and views with us in this edition.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The stroke that saved Islam from Arab-Israelite plot. In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam everybody and welcome to an exclusive feature on a special occasion. Today, the 17th of the month of Shawwal is a memorable day in history on which, in the year 5 AH, corresponding to 627 AD, Islam triumphed over a joint Arab-Israelite plot, with Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, proclaiming one of his famous statements. The stroke of Ali on the day of Khandaq is superior to the worship of Thagalain, that is mankind and genies. Dear listeners, stay with us for some interesting facts. Thus spoke the Prophet of Islam when his dear cousin and son-in-law, Imam Ali, peace upon him, emerged unscathed from the cloud of dust after a life and death combat with the now fallen champion of the Arabs, Amr ibn Abdu'l-Wahd, who, as the embodiment of infidelity, was also the representative of the Israelites in a joint bid to obliterate Islam. Why did the Messenger of Mercy hail the stroke of Dhul-Faqar, or the twin-bladed sword of Imam Ali, peace upon him, as better than the acts of worship of all mankind, acts that include prayers, fasting, supplications, piety, jihad, martyrdom, recitation and explanation of the Noble Qur'an, philanthropy, exploring human and rational sciences, and etc.? Were all those companions that had gathered around the Prophet of Peace since the declaration of his monotheistic mission and endured persecution and displacement from their homes and would set up the caliphate after him for spreading Muslim rule over large parts of Asia, Africa, and Europe, insignificant creatures compared to this single act of Imam Ali, peace upon him? Was the mercy unto the creation swayed by bonds of blood and kinship to express such a statement, recorded diligently by all the compilers of hadith, whether Sunni or Shiite, for the person whom he had groomed since childhood, years before divine revelation, dawned upon him and he began to acquire followers. It is outright blasphemy to entertain such thoughts about Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, regarding whose flawless integrity and truthfulness the Almighty Creator says in the opening ayahs of Surah Najm, in response to the doubts raised by some of those who had developed companionship with him. Your companion, the Prophet, has neither gone astray nor gone amiss, nor does he speak out of his own desire. It is just the revelation that is revealed to him. It is also worth noting that God Almighty, who has immortalized in the Noble Quran the chaotic situation of the neo-Muslims and the ideas of apostasy that flashed across the minds of several of the Prophet's companions at the sight of the formidable 10,000-strong force of Arab-Israelite confederates besieging Medina during the crucial events of the Battle of Khandaq, has also made it crystal clear in this same surah titled Ahzab, or the Confederates, in ayah 21, in the Prophet of Allah, there is certainly for you a good exemplar for those who look forward to Allah and the last day and remember Allah greatly. It is outside the scope of this brief radio program to go into details of the Battle of Khandaq, so called because of the ditch dug around the vulnerable parts of Medina as a barrier to invasion on the suggestion of the Prophet's Iranian companion Salman Farsi, an unprecedented practice in Arabia. Therefore, in order to better understand the dynamism of Islam, the wisdom of the Prophet's words, and the peerless personality of his divinely designated vicegerent, Imam Ali, peace upon him, here are ayahs 10 to 20 of Surah Ahzab regarding the Muslims of weak faith and the hypocrites amongst them, as well as the faithful whom the Lord Most High has eulogized. When they came at you from above and below you, and when the eyes rolled with fear and the hearts leapt to the throats, and you entertained misgivings about Allah. And when the hypocrites were saying, as well as those in whose hearts is a sickness, Allah and His Prophet did not promise us anything except delusion. And when a group of them said, O people of Yathrib, this is not a place for you, so go back. And a group of them sought the Prophet's permission, saying, Our homes lie exposed to the enemy. Although they were not exposed, they only sought to flee. Had they been invaded from its flanks, and had they been asked to apostatize, they would have done so with only a mild hesitation, though they had certainly pledged to Allah before that they would not turn their backs to flee, and pledges given to Allah are accountable. Say, flight will not avail you should you flee from death or from being killed, and then you will be led to enjoy only for a little while. Allah knows those of you who discourage others, and those who say to their brethren, "Come to us," and they take little part in the battle, grudging you their help. So, when there is panic, you see them observing you, their eyes rolling like someone fainting at death. Then, when the panic is over, they scold you with their sharp tongues. In their greed for riches, they never have had faith. So Allah has made their works fail, and that is easy for Allah. They suppose the Confederates have not left yet, and were the Confederates to come again, they would wish they were in the desert with the Bedouins asking about your news, and if they were with you, they would fight but a little. This vivid description by God Almighty is not of the pagan Arabs, Israelites, and other enemies of Islam. It was the state of affairs on the day of the Battle of Khandaq, of the weak faith and hypocrites amongst the Prophet's companions, which no Muslim can dispute. Here we recite to you ayahs 22 and 23 of this same Surah Ahzab, in which the Almighty Creator then praises the Prophet's few faithful companions who stood their ground, and it is obvious as to whom the reference is. But when the faithful saw the Confederates, they said, "This is what Allah and His Prophet had promised us, and Allah and His Prophet were true." And it only increased them in faith and submission. Among the faithful are men who fulfill what they have pledged to Allah. Of them are some who have fulfilled their pledge, and of them are some who still wait, and they have not changed in the least. Imam Ali, peace upon him, who has said in explicit words that Ayah 23 directly refers to him, took the field on the command of the Prophet, and after inviting Amr ibn Abdubad to Islam and receiving a negative reply, challenged him to fight and sent him to the netherworld, but not before allowing him to renew the life and death combat, because the cowardly representative of the Arab-Israelite Confederates, when hurled to the ground, had dared to spit at him. That was among the reasons the Prophet hailed his cousin's selfless feat that was solely for the sake of God and without personal emotions involved in the combat, as superior to the worship of all mankind and genies, since he knew the plot of the fifth column amongst his companions, who in case of Amr's triumph intended to hand over the Prophet over to the Arab-Israelite Confederates in order to obliterate Islam. When Amr ibn Abdubad was killed, the Arab-Israelite force, which was watching the combat from the other side of the ditch, lost heart, and as God Almighty sent strong gales to disrupt their encampment, the enemies fled. Ayah 25 of Surah Ahzab says in this regard, "Allah turned back the faithless in their rage, without their attaining any advantage. And Allah spared the faithful of fighting, and Allah is all strong, almighty."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.